Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to the December 14th edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and Tim McKenna is in studio with me, too. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Diane.
How are you?
Warm and fabulous.
Yeah, because it's cold and miserable out there. I was like, 12 degrees this morning and 18 degrees when I came into the studio. It's cold!
It's December.
It is December. So, did you enjoy your radio debut last week?
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, it's really nice to have you back. I'm glad I didn't scare you away.
It'll take a lot more than a little radio show to...
Well, I guess we should just say a couple of words about our food bank fundraiser from Monday. We collected 265 pounds of food. Tim was at the event with me, and we had 53 people who showed up at La Taqueria. Thank you very much, Brian, and all of the people at Taqueria. Boy, were they nice or what?
They were fabulous.
Yeah, and the food was fabulous, and the margaritas were fabulous. And we do not have a money tally yet, because all the money isn't in from signmeup.com. But it was really, really nice, and thanks to everybody who helped to raise money for the Cleveland Area Food Bank. All right, there's been a lot going on this past week in the world of cycling. We're not going to waste any more time. Let's move right on with our show. Our first guest is Jana Chernitz. Jana is an attorney who specializes in environmental and equity issues. She's an advocate at the Tri-State Transportation Campaign from New Jersey. Jana focuses on pedestrian and bike safety improvements and advocating for more responsible transportation spending and investment decisions as part of the state's Transportation Trust Fund reauthorization. She recently co-authored a blog on the TSTC website about Rutherford, New Jersey's bike ring and what government did to whitewash an otherwise quote-unquote done deal. Jana will be with me in a moment. You never know what the reaction to the name Lance Armstrong will be these days, and there is a lot of bitterness, anger, and disappointment because of him and his conduct. The Livestrong Foundation, too, has been poked and prodded and caught in the crossfire of the controversy. And this evening, we're going to speak with CEO and president of Livestrong, Doug Ullman, about his role, how the foundation is managing, and what the future looks like. I don't often editorialize like this, but I do want to preface my interview with Doug with a few words. There are those who have been seriously harmed, personally and financially, by Lance Armstrong and the tactics he employed. There is no question that pretty much everything he did in those days to protect his secrets and further his own interests was often spiteful and mean, and those who supported him may also have helped to hide the truth. And Livestrong, formerly known as the Lance Armstrong Foundation, originally founded to help others, has taken its share of hits, both financially and in the media, for everything from protecting and enriching Lance to squandering resources on non-cancer projects. I've read the articles, I've talked with people, I've done as much research as I can. But in the end, all I can do is try to ask the right questions and hope for honest and fair answers. I have no judgments here. I am not pro-Lance, nor anti-Foundation, or otherwise have any axe to grind. I am, however, interested in what Doug Ullman has to say, and I'm offering him the same courtesy and space to say it as any other guest. Doug will be with me in the second half of the show. Tim and I will squeeze in some current events, so let's head on out to New Jersey and talk with bicycle advocate Jana Chernitz. Jana, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
I want you to tell us about your work in bicycle advocacy and where you're based.
Great. I am based out of New York City. I work for an organization called Tri-State Transportation Campaign. And Tri-State meaning downstate New York, which would be Putnam, Rockland, Westchester, Dutchess, Orange County, Long Island, and the five boroughs of New York City, Connecticut, and New Jersey.
Wow, that's a huge territory.
It's big. We've got a lot going on around here.
Wow. So what is the transportation campaign? What is it that your work encompasses?
Well, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary.
Wow.
This year, actually, in November. We are a nonprofit, philanthropically funded transportation policy watchdog organization. We work on issues such as sustainable transportation, providing transportation choice, bicycle and pedestrian issues, funding, both state, local, and federal funding issues, and increasing access and capacity with public transportation. So moving away from the automobile.
You must be really happy with what's going on in Manhattan. Well, just New York City in general, between Mayor Bloomberg and Transportation Commissioner Sadiq Khan. Wow, you really landed right in the middle of that.
Yeah, we did. New York City is doing some wonderful things in terms of increasing access to the city for cyclists. And hopefully we'll be able to bring some of those things to the other parts of the downstate New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey.
And that's part of what we're going to talk about today. Although I know you're an SRTS, Safe Routes to School person. Tell me what your project was yesterday, and then I promise we'll talk about the Rutherford thing.
Well, I'd love to talk about it. It was a wonderful day I had yesterday. Well, I wear three hats with Tri-State. One as a lobbyist, one as attorney, and one as advocate. And yesterday I got to actually wear an educational hat to throw a fourth one into the ring. For Safe Routes to Schools, I was working with a town, Linden, actually it's the city of Linden, and school number 6 did about 6 pedestrian safety assemblies, one for each grade, K-5. And we talked for about a half an hour with the students about how to be safe pedestrians.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you also do similar things with bicycles?
I personally have not done that yet,
okay.
But that is part of something that Tri-State does do.
So I do want to talk about the issue that first brought me to you, and that is this Rutherford, New Jersey whitewashed issue, something that happened up there with this bicycle ring. Why don't you give us some background first, and then we'll talk about the meeting of November 13th.
Sure. Just so everybody knows where Rutherford is, that's the infamous Meadowlands area where the Super Bowl is going to be happening in February.
I see.
So, so that's the area that we're talking about when we're talking about this Rutherford bike ring, which is what's going on up there. To give you a little bit of background, the Rutherford bike ring encircles Rutherford, and it connects with the Meadowlands, with the stadium complex and some other destinations that are in the Meadowlands. There's museums in there, a nature center. So this bike ring is really a regional project.
How many miles is it? Or is that how you're measuring it?
I was looking actually for the actual mileage, but I wasn't able to find that. But it encircles the entire borough of Rutherford and connects it with the Meadowlands area.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. So this ring, this bike ring, this concept had been in the works for about 3 years. And it's important to note that it had overwhelming support from not only the borough government, but state and federal elected officials. There was support from Senator Bob Menendez, Congressman Steve Rothman, the New Jersey Meadowlands Commission, Hackensack Riverkeeper, Rutherford Downtown Partnership, police departments, schools, health departments. You name it, they supported it. The project's list of support was very impressive, and it really looked like a who's who in the region. So the study for the bike ring was made possible by a combination of two grants, one being from the National Park Service. This was a technical planning assistant grant through the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. And then the New Jersey Department of Transportation, the NJDOT's Office of Bicycle and Pedestrian Programs, really that grant went to the actual planning, the pen to paper planning of the bike ring. All in all, when you combine both of those grants, it was a total of $115,000 in taxpayer-supported planning and design assistance. So this was no small project, in terms of funding, and no small project in terms of regional significance and regional significance for bicycle planning.
Was this bike ring strictly for bicycles and or pedestrians? Or, I mean, it is an off-road, not sharing the road.
It is sharing the road.
Oh, it is sharing the road.
Yeah, it is sharing the road. It was for designated bike lanes, and then it would connect to the trails.
Got
it. That's why you had the National Park Service come in, because of its connection with the Meadowlands region. But it was it had a pedestrian component to it, because it's, of course, when you add bike lanes, you narrow the road, and that's traffic calming.
Right.
Slows down the roads, makes it safer for motorists, for bicyclists and for pedestrians. And the project did involve a lot of engineering tools, such as bump outs to narrow, wide intersections. And to give you an idea of some of the lanes, as far as the bike ring is concerned, Orient Way, which is the hot topic here for this discussion, is 60 feet wide, and 60 feet is the distance between home plate and the pitching mound.
Okay.
Minus 6 inches.
Right. Okay.
But that's to give you and that's how wide these lanes are. And for the most part, they just have a center dividing line, so you've got 30-foot travel lanes in each direction.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, adding these bike lanes would significantly narrow these roads, bring down the speed limit, the actual speed limit. Legal speed limit is 35, but we all know the wider the road, the faster people are going to drive.
Right. Would they actually physically change the speed limit on those roads down to, say, 30 or 25?
Well, this part of this entire traffic calming project, it's not just the infrastructure, but there was talk of the borough perhaps looking into reducing the speed limit to 20 from 35 to 25. But you know, that's just part of what would actually help with the reducing the overall speed. We've got to reduce the travel lanes, you know, do these traffic calming engineering improvements, and you know, coupled with that, we could bring that speed down.
So then we had a meeting November 13th, and what happened at that meeting?
Okay, so let's just want to back up to September to really bring us home with November.
Okay.
So just so everybody knows, over these past 3 years, the Rutherford Borough passed about 5 resolutions, all unanimous, in support of the bike ring. So now we're up to September. The bike ring has been unveiled. They want to move forward with it. As I said, this is, you know, unanimous support, not only from the borough, but from, you know, the who's who in the region. And in September, there was a handful of residents who came to the meeting, and they presented the borough with a petition. About 73 residents signed the petition that they were concerned of having dedicated bike lanes on their street, and their street meaning Orient Way. What they were saying was that they were concerned about the safety of having the bike lanes, not the safety so much as for the cyclists, but they were concerned about driveway obstruction, bus traffic, delivery truck passage, to name a few things.
Wait a minute. We're talking 70 people out of how many who may or may not be affected by the whole bike ring?
I couldn't tell you how many exact people, but it was 70 people who, about 70, 73 people who showed up with this petition.
Okay.
So after that meeting, the Rutherford Green Team, who has really been the driving force for this bike ring, and this person by the name of John Hughes, he started a petition in support of the bike ring after the result of the September Borough Council meeting. And in October presented a petition with 250 signatures.
Okay, so now we're 3 times as many.
Correct.
Okay.
And I should say that out of the 250, 125 were from Rutherford. The petition was circulated not only through the Green Team's website, but New Jersey Bike and Walk Coalition became involved, as well as Tri-State Transportation Campaign in getting the word out about what was going on in Rutherford. So over the month, with the efforts of our three groups, we were able to get 250 signatures. At the October meeting, about 2 hours worth of public testimony occurred. Probably fair to say that it was half in favor and half opposed to the bike lanes. But it was interesting to note that there was a common concern amongst everybody who was testifying, regardless of the side of the issue you were on, of the overall concern to make Rutherford streets safer, and specifically make Orient Way safer.
I'm speaking with Janet Chernitz. We're on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're talking about an issue in Rutherford, New Jersey for the Tri-State Transportation Campaign. We're talking about this Rutherford bike ring. So, okay, now we're moving towards this November meeting. Go ahead.
Okay, so in October, as a result of all the public testimony, one of the councilwomen said that she wanted her engineer, the borough engineer, to create 2 additional renderings with traffic calming, one with the bike lanes and one without, which would be presented at the next borough council meeting.
Okay.
So now we fast forward to November. On the agenda for the November 13th council meeting was the fact to discuss the new renderings for Orient Way. And this is where it sounds odd, but this is actually what happened. The renderings were presented, and they really did not look anything like or anything close to what was originally drawn for the Rutherford bike ring.
Who did these renderings?
These are from the borough engineer.
And who did the previous renderings?
It was the group that did it was Baker Engineering Group.
Okay.
So they were the ones that received the grant from the DOT to complete the project.
Wow.
For Rutherford. So the borough engineer created two renderings, and the borough engineer's renderings did not have any of the bump outs that we talked about to narrow the intersections to make them shorter and safer for pedestrians to cross. It essentially created two 13-foot travel lanes, one in each direction. That's it.
Whoa. So wait. They took a project that had already been in the works for 3 years and in the space of 30 days or so completely altered it without anybody but just the local engineers. What happened to this $100,000+ grant that started the whole thing? I mean, it's sort of like they threw the whole thing out the window or worse, swept it under the rug.
You know, I can't make this up. You know, and I should mention that from the time that it was presented, these new renderings, until it was passed was probably about 10 minutes. So there was no time for anybody to take a look at these renderings, and there was no time for any public discussion or comment on them.
So you're saying that these renderings are the ones the council accepted?
That's correct.
Wait a minute. So there was no comparing to the old ones. This is the new plan, and the old plan's just out the window?
Well, I wouldn't say it's totally out the window.
Okay.
Let me clarify that. Like that, there's talks about bringing this back onto the table in the spring, but for now, what they're going to go with are these new renderings. You know, 13-foot travel lanes. That's larger than a freeway travel lane.
Right. Right.
And we're going a lot faster on the freeway. So, you know, it's on the table again for the spring. But what's done is done for now. We went out there a couple weeks ago, and there was still nothing done. So there's no striping done, and as far as I know, as of today, there is no actual striping done. It's not over.
Well, what do you believe happened? I mean, so we had 70-some-odd people signing one petition, 240 people signing another petition,
right.
a council that up until that moment was saying, you know, here are our renderings. We like this idea. And you had such good support for the idea.
It did.
Where did it fall apart? What happened, do you think?
I don't know how
okay.
it fell apart. It was extremely shocking that we even got here. I would have never in a million years imagined that this could happen. And actually, I'm interested to figure out how 70 people can make such a big difference, because I need to learn from that. But, you know, the whole entire process is just completely baffling. And, you know, let me throw another wrench into this. I'm sure you are aware as well of your listeners about Complete Streets.
Right, of course.
Complete Streets policy, sure. And Rutherford passed a Complete Streets policy in 2010.
So wait, that's 3 years ago, and this is a new project, therefore Complete Streets should apply.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And, you know, we've thought about, you know, different ways to approach this, you know, not only advocacy, but legal ways to approach this.
Right.
But it is really, you know, when this boils down, this is not just a New Jersey project. This is not just a project that only people in New Jersey should be concerned about and only people of Rutherford should be concerned about. It dilutes the potency of Complete Streets policies. That a borough that has passed a policy 3 years ago that's pledged its devotion to make roads safer for all users can do this.
Have you found any legal recourse yet?
We're exploring the possibility.
Okay.
We're exploring the pro. You know, if there is legal recourse, what the pros and cons are of that, and what that would mean for future advocacy and for, you know, the future of Complete Streets. But, you know, really, when you peel off all the layers, you know, this is such an important project, not only for New Jersey, but for the nation.
When you and I were having our, you know, back and forth conversation before our interview today, we also talked about the fact that there is another component to what is happening with bicycles and pedestrians in the area because of what happened with Storm Sandy last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that these kinds of projects are important to the health of the community, specifically with tourism. So what happened with the Jersey Shore, and how far is Rutherford from that? I mean, I don't have a New Jersey picture in my mind exactly. It's not a huge state.
No, and you could say, like, what exit is the Meadowlands and what exit is the shore? We're talking maybe about 50 miles or so.
Okay. What exactly will the Tri-State Transportation Campaign be able to do as far as tourism and putting some, you know, you talked about Route 35 and that there's been pushback there also? I mean, we want to think of New Jersey as being progressive, and yet here it is looking a little regressive, it looks like.
Yeah. You know, Superstorm Sandy was really devastating to New Jersey. And I know everybody has seen the pictures of the washed out homes and businesses, roads and bridges. It brought the entire state and the entire region to a standstill. You couldn't drive anywhere. You couldn't take mass transit. You know, rails were washed away. It was amazing to see such a hustling and bustling area come to a complete stop. So, you know, as an advocate, we've got to look at the silver lining. And the silver lining is, okay, we're going to rebuild smarter. We're going to rebuild better. We're going to rebuild stronger. And how do we do that? One of the biggest Sandy rebuild projects as far on my radar and as far as I'm concerned is the rebuild of about 12.5 miles of Route 35 along New Jersey shore.
And so is there a plan to put some designated bike lanes near the shore?
Well, Diane, the jury is still out on that.
Unbelievable.
It is.
It seems like such a no-brainer to me.
It does. You know, when you look at the Jersey Shore, you see families on their bicycles. You see, you know, the light pink and the light blue beach cruisers, you know, with the towels and the baskets and, you know, people heading for ice cream and then down to the beach.
Right.
Now, that's the area that we're talking about. You know, what a better place to put designated bike lanes. And I'll tell you that as soon as Governor Christie announced the project in February, you know, Tri-State Transportation Campaign, we were on it. New Jersey Bike Walk Coalition, they were helping out with us. And even Philadelphia was concerned about what was going on Route 35. Again, another project that has not only local significance, but national significance.
Where does that project stand now? We're talking 12.5 miles. It could mean jobs. Mm-hmm. It could mean, I mean, there are a lot of upsides to this. I'm not seeing too many downsides.
I'm not seeing any too many downsides either, to be perfectly honest with you. You've got a lot of bicycle shops along the way that could, you know, benefit not only from bike sales, but from bike rentals.
Again, I don't see any negative here of having, you know, the opportunity of rebuilding. I mean, you had utter devastation. You get to start from scratch. Why wouldn't anybody want this to happen?
It's a million-dollar question.
Okay.
I really, really don't know. We had support from a couple of communities, a couple of municipalities along Route 35 that actually passed resolutions in support of bike lanes and sidewalks. Let's not forget about the pedestrian component.
Well, true.
You know, we have pedestrians who are, you know, we have people who are walking from their shore rentals to the beach because parking is that's some prime real estate. You know, you get a parking spot at 6 a.m., you're not moving your car. Hmm. And if you do want a parking spot, let me tell you, you've got to get down there early.
Wow.
So, you know, this, you know, walking and taking your bike really is, you know, just as important, if not more important, than I think, than your car. The opportunities are endless. We just have to get the infrastructure in there.
Well, it sounds to me like you have a lot of stuff on your plate.
Oh, I certainly do.
I'd like to check back and find out what's going on with the Rutherford Bike Ring. I'd also like to know what's happening with the bike lanes along the shore. So maybe in the spring, as things start moving out of the winter and doldrums, we'll check back with you and see what's going on.
Would love to. And also, just a shameless plug.
Go for it.
We do have a website, and we have a blog. Our website is tstc.org, and you can click on the link to our blog, which is called Mobilizing the Region, where we post daily, sometimes 2-3 stories a day, as what's going on in the region. So anyone who's interested in following what's going on can check back on a daily basis and even put in your emails to receive email alerts.
Well, we will indeed put that up on our Facebook page, too. Well, Jana,
great.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Good luck with all these crazy projects, and have a wonderful, happy holiday.
Thanks. Same to you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jenna Chernetz joined us from her offices in Rutherford, New Jersey. I think it's in Rutherford, New Jersey. Anyway, we are going to move right along and talk about some news for the week, the most controversial story of the year. We're in December, and it took 12 months for us to get a story this outrageous. It is Specialized Bicycles. They were handed their lunch in the court of public opinion this week when their legal team decided to pounce on one Dan Richter, the proprietor of a small bike shop in Alberta, Canada, and veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He decided to name his bike shop Cafe Roubaix. And the shriek of anger across the globe was swift and mighty as insanely upset folks posted nasty comments on the Specialized Facebook page, swore up and down to never own another Specialized product as long as they live, and began a hate campaign usually reserved for politicians. It turns out that Specialized had licensed the name Roubaix from ASI, which is the parent company of Fuji, which also, by the way, has had a Roubaix model in its line since 1992. And while not being able to get a trademark in the U.S. for the name, Specialized was able to trademark the name Roubaix in Canada. Last summer sometime, I think it was in August, the Specialized legal team sent Mr. Richter a cease and desist letter insisting that he change the name of his shop and stop using the Roubaix name on his carbon fiber wheels. As one would imagine, the issue was quickly resolved. ASI got involved and made it possible for Mr. Richter to also license the name from them. Specialized owner and CEO Mike Sinyard not only made nice by calling Mr. Richter, but decided it needed a face-to-face, took a plane, went up to his shop, and they made a little three-minute video. So you could probably go on Facebook and see Cafe Roubaix's site and see Mike Sinyard standing there saying, "I'm sorry," which is pretty awesome that he did that. I have to say it went a long way to mitigating some of the upset and anger. But Specialized does have a reputation for suing first and asking questions later. But anyway, it's win-win-win for Cafe Roubaix. So Dan Richter, woohoo, good for you. I'm really, really happy about that. Tim is going to tell you about the new long-rumored SRAM Electronics.
SRAM's development of an electronic drivetrain went public Sunday when a rider in SRAM-branded kit raced on what is clearly a prototype shift-by-wire system at the Illinois Cyclocross State Championships. SRAM is remaining tight-lipped about the group set. That's a development product. I have no comment, SRAM marketing manager Michael Zellman told Velo News. With the public, if accidental unveiling of the electronic group, SRAM joins competitors Shimano and Campagnolo in a steady move away from mechanical shifting. Little is known about the group aside from what can be seen in the photo. What is obvious is that an electric wire, not a cable, is actuating the rear derailleur. There's also something mounted to the driver's stem, which we assume is some sort of battery. The derailleur has a short cage indicating that the initial group will be targeted at the road and cyclocross markets. The shifters are matched with cable-actuated brakes, not the company's hydraulic braking system. The finish is rough, and the components are quite obviously in a prototype phase. We hope to learn more soon.
You also have the video of the week. You have to tell our listeners about this video because it is hilarious.
This video is a cross between Mythbusters and Jackass and is perfectly titled "The Most Dangerous Bike Ever." Colin Fursey from Stamford, England. In this video, he takes an old woman's bike built for shopping and adds a pulse jet engine powered by propane. That right there should be enough description to get everything that, you know, you need from this. It's a great video, shows how to build it. This has "Don't try this at home" written all over it.
Does it?
Safety seems to be the last thing that they looked at. No helmets, no gloves, no anything that was there. But what caught me is, initially I thought it was a backyard mechanic making a video, but it turns out it's not. This is for a British TV show called Gadget Geeks. It doesn't make the product any less interesting, though.
It's outrageous.
Colin was working as a plumber and competing in BMX events when YouTube came about, and he started to post a lot of his videos from biking on there. This got him out of a job on Gadget Geeks, and that's how we got to where the bike is today. This is more of a category of motorcycles, but it's a very creative use of an old bicycle. I enjoyed the video and the creativity And if anybody is interested, do a search for Bob Maddox of MaddoxJets.com, who will sell you plans for $19.95.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put that in somebody's stocking this year, not...
Well, for Cleveland, I think that would work out well. We could use it as an ice-melting device or some sort of warming device.
You have to go watch it. It's not very long. It's, I don't know... 3 minutes, 4 minutes, I don't know.
But like with YouTube, you get on all the other fun stuff that they do with it.
That's true.
It really is. It's a neat video.
Yeah. Tim may not remember, but back in October, we spoke with Richard Fries about the Providence Cyclocross Festival, and he alluded to some new stuff in 2014. Well, this week, Bicycle Retailer and Industry News posted this story, Providence to make bid for 2015 Cyclocross World Cup stop. Providence, Rhode Island, organizers of the Providence Cyclocross Festival are planning to make a bid to host a stop on the 2015 UCI Cyclocross World Cup they announced Wednesday. World Cup Cyclocross event has never been held in the U.S., although Louisville, Kentucky hosted the Cyclocross World Championships last year. We are assembling an advisory panel and developing our proposal for presentation in December of 2014, said Richard Fries, the events director. We plan to work closely with the City of Providence, the UCI, and especially USA Cycling to make this happen. It's a really high mountain for us to climb, and we'll need a lot of help. Organizers announced Wednesday that they had withdrawn from the Shimano New England Professional Cyclocross Series to allow more flexibility in scheduling. We realized that our aspirations of hosting a World Cup would conflict with the race schedule of the Shimano and Verge Series, Fries said. We felt it appropriate to allow another great New England race to benefit by membership in the Pro Series, but the process starts now. The event will continue to be held at Providence Historic Rogers Williams Park. And Tim has our final feel-good story this week.
This June, in conjunction with the Challenged Athletes Foundation, Goo Energy created Challenge for Kids in order to fulfill a critical need for children suffering from any limb loss malady, from traumatic amputations to disease state complications to congenital effects. The initiative, which included the creation of a special edition of their premier performing Roctane line, initially sought to fund $50,000 to purchase prosthetic limbs for children who hoped to regain active mobility. Today, Goo Energy is proud to announce that it has surpassed that goal and is extending the campaign in an effort to reach a new goal of $100,000. Goo is extending production of the special edition flavored Roctane Passion Fruit and directs all profits from it to the Challenge for Kids Fund, so any purchase of the gel aids the effort directly.
Nice.
It is a nice feel-good story. So
it is a good feel, and good for Goo. Yay, yay. Go Goo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Friday, December 20th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., you can escape the hustle and bustle of the holiday season by retreating to nature at night during Cleveland Metro Park's free candlelit hike and caroling event at Lookabout Lodge. Walk through the beautiful South Chagrin Reservation Forest, lit by candle luminaries, and spend the evening singing carols around a roaring fire. Lookabout Lodge is located at 37374 Miles Road in South Chagrin Reservation. More information at clevelandmetroparks.com.
I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head on down to Austin, Texas, and we are going to speak with the CEO and president of Live Strong, Doug Ullman. Doug, thank you so much for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. And I know you've spoken with a slew of folks from the media. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. I'd like you to start by explaining your role at Livestrong and how long you've been with the foundation.
Sure. So my role at Livestrong is I'm the president and CEO of the Livestrong Foundation, and I've been in this role for just over 6 years, although I've been with the organization for more than 12 years, having moved to Texas to work here in early 2001, and it's just been a phenomenal opportunity to be a part of something really, really special.
And you actually started out having a foundation of your own out of what happened to you, and then you sort of joined forces. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was diagnosed with cancer at 19, and as you might imagine, it was quite a harrowing experience and a shock, and something that I never dreamt would impact my life at an early age. But I was a college athlete, and I realized pretty quickly that there didn't seem to be a lot of resources for people my age, or roughly my age, people who were dealing with the hardships of being a young adult in general, much less to then layer in a cancer experience. And so not knowing any better and being entirely naive, I told my family, I said, I think we should start a foundation to help young adults with cancer. And we did that. I did that as a volunteer from my dorm room for several years. And then a few years after graduating from college, I had the opportunity to meet some of the board members and people that were involved in the foundation here, and just loved what they were thinking about doing and the opportunity that they had in front of them. And they asked me to come to Austin and join them. And it, you know, again, it's been a wild roller coaster ride, as you might imagine. But the opportunity to get up every day and have an impact on the world is has never been greater here, and that's what excites me.
So you alluded to it. How are you holding up under all of the things that have gone on since really a long time? But I guess it really started hitting the fan around June.
Yeah, I mean it's been a long process, and I would say that every day things get better, personally
oh, good.
And professionally. You know, I think a lot of these experiences take time, you know, to sort of heal and to allow people the requisite sort of a grieving time. But it's been challenging. It's been stressful. It's been overwhelming at times. I describe the experience in terms of the three P's. There's the professional side, which is has been extremely challenging. There's the personal side, which is the relationships and the personal nature of sort of what we've been through. And then there's the public side and the reality that this was a very public story and experience all around the world. And, you know, I wouldn't wish this type of experience on anyone, and I don't think I could have understood or estimated the impact of each of those areas when combined. Because any one of them on its own during a crisis would be hard enough. But when you layer in the personal piece and the public piece, it made it incredibly, incredibly stressful and challenging.
Well, one of the things I want to do today is sort of clear up for listeners what exactly the foundation was built to do. Because most people think, oh, well, it's research. And the truth is the focus of Livestrong has never been research. And a lot of people think maybe it should be. But explain the scope of Livestrong and what it is you're trying to do for cancer patients and their families.
Absolutely. So initially when the organization was started back in 1997, which in and of itself is a little known fact, the reality that it has started so many years ago, 16 years ago. At that time, the organization was raising money, and they were interested in funding some research. And so for the first year, that's what they did. And after about a year or two, they realized that, and this was before I was involved, but they realized that there was a bigger opportunity. They realized that one of the biggest voids in the cancer community was in the area of what we call survivorship and quality of life. How do you dramatically improve someone's quality of life once they are diagnosed with cancer? And, you know, the other reality is, and the board at that time understood this, was that there were billions and billions and billions of dollars going into cancer research every year. And when I say cancer research, I'm referring to sort of basic science and biomedical research. And the reality was that the resources that we had as an organization were a drop in the bucket. But on the other side of the equation, this idea that because of the money that's been spent on cancer research for decades now, the great news is there are more and more people who are surviving the disease.
Right.
The downside of that is there are more and more people who need significant resources to go back to their life, which is no longer sort of normal. It's a new normal. The organization decided, hey, let's focus on this growing group of patients and survivors, and let's help them get not even back to their life, but get to a new level of life in terms of their quality. And so we started initially funding research in that area. So the research that we have funded over many years now and continue to fund is looking at things like what happens to someone 10 years post-treatment. Do they have other issues medically? Do they have other risks of secondary cancers? Do they have psychosocial and late effects that impact their ability to work or their cognition? You know, what happens to people post-cancer? And that research actually informs all of our programs and the work that we do. So we are solely focused on improving people's lives from the day they're diagnosed moving forward, and that includes the individual with cancer as well as their family. And we offer an array of services and programs to focus on that population, which I can talk about if you'd like.
We will, but I want to ask you a question that just came up for me out of what you just said, and that is, can you give me an example of what you found about somebody? And you are the perfect example, because I don't know how many years post, you know, recovery post-cancer you are, but you are one of those statistics. What have you found about people, say, 10 years down the road? What does change for people like that? What kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, from my own experience, I can tell you that everything changed. You know, I was in the prime of my life. I mean, I was a 19-year-old student-athlete at a great university and, you know, had great parents, wonderful brother. I mean, I had everything. And, you know, post my cancer diagnosis, I had to think about things that never would have crossed my mind. So I had to think about things like fertility. Would I be able to have kids post-cancer? I had to think about things like, how would I ever be able to get life insurance? I had to think about things like health insurance. When I graduated from college and was no longer on my parents' health plan, how would I get health insurance now that I had a pre-existing condition? I thought about sort of what I envisioned my life to be prior to cancer and what it's like now. It's totally different. I would not be working where I am. It would not have given me a perspective or the opportunity that I've had. And so I think for a lot of individuals with cancer, it changes their outlook. It changes their approach, and then ultimately there's sort of the psychosocial, the PTSD sort of effect of the experience. You know, one of the things we have at the foundation is cancer may leave your body, but it never leaves your life.
Wow, yeah, sure, I can believe that.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a day goes by that I don't think about it. You know, if I get a cold, I think, oh, is this a precursor to something? And then on the clinical side, you know, again, for many, many years, the way that we as a society treated cancer was to basically provide or give as much therapy as possible in an attempt to cure someone. And what we now realize is that therapy actually is causing secondary cancers.
What do you mean? Whoa. What do you mean? Explain that.
Yeah, I'll give you a few examples.
Okay.
So years ago, women who would receive radiation to their chest for, let's say, Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Okay.
Those women who received radiation to their chest were at way higher risk of getting breast cancer later on because
sure.
of the radiation.
I get it.
We now know that certain types of chemotherapy cause a dramatically increased risk of heart disease. So we are seeing thousands of people in their 30s and 40s who had cancer as teenagers who are having heart attacks at a much earlier age than they should or would. And it's primarily related to a specific chemotherapy drug that they had 20 years ago during their treatment. And so these are survivorship issues because ultimately, until recently, we didn't have this knowledge. So now, if we're treating people with these agents, we actually tell them, you need to make sure you have mammography earlier than the general population
sure.
because of what you've been through. And so the knowledge is empowering, but it's still a long-term and late effect of the cancer experience, which is challenging. The other piece that we see a lot of that is not going to be a surprise to you or any of the listeners, but the financial aspects. So, you know, medical issues are the number one cause of bankruptcy in our country, and then within that, there's a subset of obviously cancer diagnoses that cause people to end up in financial ruin. And that can last for decades. So those are just a few of the challenges that a cancer experience can bring that may last a lot longer than people might imagine. I'll give you one last small anecdote that I always like to talk about. But, you know, because I was diagnosed when I was 19 and in college, I still have friends from college, and this is many years ago, who, when I see them, they ask me things like, "How do you feel?"
Yeah, expecting, you know, something different from what from
exactly.
Yeah,
I mean,
interesting.
And I like to joke with them. I like to run a lot, and so I like to joke with them. And I look at them and I say, "I feel great. I just ran a marathon. How do you feel?" You know, I mean, you know,
right.
In their mind,
you're
context,
still sick in a way.
I'm still the kid that had cancer in
sure.
college. And so that can be a challenge to sort of people moving on with their life.
I'm speaking with Doug Ullman. He is the president and CEO of the Livestrong Foundation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Those are fascinating things. So tell me, all right, somebody calls into the foundation or comes to the foundation. What kinds of programs can they expect to participate in, or can you help them with? What would you do for somebody calling in or coming into the foundation or a family member?
Absolutely. So we hear from thousands of people every year, and we provide a number of services. But the first touch point is our navigation program. So if you or somebody you love has been diagnosed with cancer, we would encourage them to call or go online immediately and enter our navigation program, which is staffed by a team of navigators who are all bilingual. Many of them are licensed clinical social workers or counselors, and they will go through an in-depth intake of your situation. And then they will offer an array of services. So if you're just newly diagnosed, you might be looking for a clinical trial. So we have a great clinical trials matching service, which will identify all the clinical options that are available to you. If you have financial need, we will connect you with one of our financial navigators who will make sure that you are signed up for any programs that are out there that could provide financial assistance during your experience. If you need psychosocial support, one of our counselors will provide that in one-on-one fashion, free of charge, for 8 sessions. And, you know, the list goes on and on. And then we have programs that we run across the country that we can refer people to. One example would be our partnership with the YMCA. So it's called Live Strong at the Y. Great example of a program that was based entirely on research. So the research years ago showed that doctors were telling their patients with cancer that they needed to go home and rest.
Right.
And we all know that that was exactly the opposite of what they needed.
Right, exactly.
Because, I mean, rest was breeding fatigue, it was breeding depression, it was sort of the worst case. And so we funded a study actually at Harvard about 10 years ago that took women with breast cancer who had lymphedema drainage in their arm, took them rowing on the Charles River in Boston.
Wow.
And these are women who previous to this, the doctors would tell them, you can't lift anything with that arm that's more than 10 pounds. And so, you know, the physician community was, you know, not in favor of this study. Well, these women who became rowers and went rowing on the Charles River, not only did they have a dramatically improved quality of life, but they actually had better long-term outcomes from their therapy.
So do you take some of this information and feed it back into the medical community? Are they listening to these kinds of
absolutely?
Oh, well, that's
absolutely.
A good thing. That's
so
a good thing.
Yeah. So we took that research and we then went and partnered with the American College of Sports Medicine and we developed a 12-week training program for people to get active, whether they're in treatment or just post-treatment. And so we got that program certified, and then we looked for a partner that could disseminate that program. And the Y was a natural partner because they have just vast geographic diversity in their locations.
Sure.
And so the Live Strong at the Y program is now free of charge, 12-week training program for the individual with cancer as well as their family, and it's offered at 300 Ys across the country. And so it's an example of something that's based in research that clearly fills a need. And then we try to identify a partner to sort of implement it so that we don't have to build the infrastructure across the country. And there are other examples, but I guess the most important thing that I would emphasize is that we want to intervene and help people as soon as possible post a diagnosis. And our navigators are trained to do just that, and people can, again, access them by phone or online.
I want to talk about the million pound elephant in the room, and that is fundraising, which, of course, without fundraising, you know, there is no health to a nonprofit. I know that encouraging donations, you know, you took such a huge hit this year from Nike and a bunch of other sponsors. What are you doing that is not only distancing yourself from, you know, the founder, but more about, is there going to be a new face to Live Strong? For example, you're doing something that's completely different from cycling. You're going to be climbing, what, Mount Kilimanjaro or something? You're doing something outrageous.
I am. I can't wait. I've never done anything like it, and I'm excited about it. You know, we are evolving as an organization. Fundraising has been extremely challenging. Our funding in 2013 is down probably about 30%. Compared to 2012, and that's to be expected.
Yeah, that's actually less of a number than I would have thought.
Most people have that reaction. but the reality is the organization is much more focused than we've ever been. We're much more clear about what we're doing and where we're going, and the evolution of the organization, I think, is going to take time. But fundraising has been challenging, for sure. And you know, one of the reasons is we don't have a huge budget for marketing. So for us to tell our story and get our message out is challenging when you're competing with a sort of visible crisis that's sort of dominating the airwaves.
Sure.
So it's been challenging, but you know, I'm an eternal optimist, and I see such huge potential. And at the same time that we've had challenges from a development standpoint, you know, we're also so grateful to people who continue to support us and to people who have stepped up as new and first-time donors in 2013, of which there have been thousands and thousands of them, because these are people who really understand what we do and believe in the mission. And so, you know, while it's been challenging, I'm really optimistic about 2014 and beyond.
So are you thinking of launching any new programs in 2014? Is there anything that's coming up online that will sort of move in a different direction? Or are you going to stick with survivorship and families? Or is there anything new, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, so I think the what we realized through our strategic planning this year is that while everything around us has changed, the need for what we do has not changed. But what has changed is the need to communicate and to operate in a different way. You know, we were so fortunate for so many years to have the visibility of our founder.
Sure.
Which helped drive involvement. It helped drive fundraising. It helped, you know, all the things that you're well aware of. And that is gone. That sort of cycle of visibility that was so generous to us is gone. And so we've got to operate differently. And we've got to drive people's attention in a different way. And so I think that's what you'll see a lot of. You know, you'll see we're launching a social innovation competition, as an example, in the early spring to engage entrepreneurs from all over the world in our mission. And so on the one hand, it involves them by getting them to build tools and products that are valuable to people's lives. But on the other hand, it educates them about who we are and what we do, because it will involve people at universities and in entrepreneurial sort of settings around the world. We're also looking at a major partnership with the University of Texas on a new effort that we've undertaken with them, and that will be announced in hopefully in early 2014. So I think it's a combination of announcing some things that are big and bold and that will get people's attention and hopefully refocus their attention on what we do and why it's so important. But at the end of the day, you know, the mission is not broken and the need is not broken in any way, shape, or form. We've just got to capture people's minds and hearts in a different operational manner.
Well, maybe, you know, a new face will come on board, too. Have you thought about that?
We have. We've talked a lot about that. And, you know, one of the things that we're really focused on is sort of democratizing the approach.
Interesting.
And having the faces of everyday survivors be the face and really telling people's stories and having Livestrong be a platform for anyone who's interested in this work, whether they be visible in their field or sector or whether they be somebody that no one knows, because the experience of cancer is so personal. And we want to sort of be that democratized platform for people to say, you know what, I want to get involved, and I don't need to start my own foundation, and I don't need to, you know, I can go use Livestrong as a way to tell my story or a way to get involved as a supporter or a volunteer, et cetera. So we're focused on that for the moment, but obviously the more people that want to get involved, the better.
And social media, that's a good thing for you?
Oh, it's been great. It's been great. It's caused headaches, and it's been stressful. And, you know, all the things that come with the tools, but it's allowed us, especially during the last year, it's allowed us to communicate in real time with a large number of people and in a transparent way. And I'm not sure what we would have done, quite honestly, if this was 10, 15 years ago. I'm not sure how we would have, given that we don't have a huge budget, given that we don't have the marketing dollars to sort of blast our story, without these free tools, I'm not sure how we would have communicated so quickly with so many people.
I think a lot of people feel that way. Well, you know, I hope that our conversation gives people a better picture of Livestrong in a light that isn't so overshadowed by everything that's gone on with Lance. You know, a great interview came out today between Lance and I think it's Joe Lindsay from ESPN maybe. And it was an excellent interview, and you know, and you can see he's trying to work his way back as a human being. But the separation between the two of you, I guess, had to be made, and I wanted to offer a platform, especially not just for you, but for my friend who is on your board, to say, you know, it's time for Livestrong to have something to say to the cycling community who listens to the show. And I'm really glad you came on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for the opportunity. And, you know, again, we feel so fortunate to be focused on this mission. And I'm so proud of my colleagues who spend their days doing this work with us, and just really appreciate the opportunity, so thank you.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful holiday. Go climb a mountain. And be safe. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Doug Ullman, who's the president and CEO of Livestrong, joined me from Austin, Texas. What do you think, Tim?
I think it was a great interview.
He was pretty forthright. I appreciated that he was willing to just answer any question we asked. What do you think needs to happen with Livestrong? Do you have any ideas?
I think one of the interesting things is when you ask if there's going to be a new face for it. I think Doug would be a great face for that.
I think he would too, but I think he would say, nah, I'm not going to do that. I have enough to do. But true, he's been a cancer survivor. I don't know how old he is right now, but you know, 19 was pretty young to be diagnosed. I think Lance Armstrong was pretty young when he was diagnosed too. Well, that is our show for this evening. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to know more about Livestrong, it's livestrong.org. If you want to know more about the Outspoken Cyclist, you can log on to outspokencyclist.com. You can catch us on our Facebook page. And if you're going to use our Twitter handle, it's @outspoken without an E. They didn't give me enough room for an E. Have a great weekend. It's probably too cold for a ride, but if not, keep that rubber side down. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.